Welcome to Religion in the News. This is Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next 30 minutes, we'll be featuring articles from the New York Times, from the Associated Press, from Discover Magazine, and more. This broadcast is intended for people who are blind and print impaired, and podcasts of Religion in the News are available at our website, ncreadingservice.org. We begin this week's episode of Religion in the News with an article from the November 20th edition of the New York Times. This article is entitled, Find a Little Light This Holiday Season. The subheadline, At the End of a Tough Year, Spiritual Leaders Offer Some Ways to Prepare Yourself for Whatever Comes Next. This article is by Eric Vance of the New York Times. Saying that 2020 has been a tough year is a little like saying it's been a tough match for a boxer whose opponent is using a baseball bat. Every time you look up, new punches just keep coming. Some days it feels as if the headlines batter your very soul. With a grim election season in the rear view and a seemingly grimmer winter on the horizon, perhaps it's time to reinvigorate that soul. Across the country, spiritual leaders and religious thinkers are grappling with how to encourage healing for the past and fortitude for the future. Doing this is both much harder and much easier than you might think. There are small things you can do, especially during the coming holiday season, to find light in the darkness and prepare yourself to face down whatever comes next. First, create a ritual. My understanding of how prayer operates and how meditation operates is that if you do it in order to get a fix, it's not going to work, said Rabbi Adam Kligfeld of Temple Beth Am in Los Angeles. You do it over the course of a lifetime. That said, it's an easy thing to start. Rabbi Kligfeld teaches a form of meditation where he simply sits, closes his eyes, and breathes intentionally. He's fond of sports analogies and said meditation and prayer are a little like basketball, because even if you fail 70% of the time, you're a star. The Reverend Tracy Blackman, a St. Louis-based pastor in the United Church of Christ, is up at 4 a.m. every morning to quietly pray and prepare for her day. I have a disciplined prayer life, she said. It's the way I live my life because it's the only way I can get grounded. If you're not interested in prayer, find an activity that brings you peace. Several religious leaders recommended reading stories from history to connect with the past and see how other people faced adversity. But Ms. Blackman said the important thing is to make room in your life for deep contemplation and stick to it. Second, drop in on a service. Many people are curious about religious services, but intimidated to wander into a strange place of worship. But now, you can just hop online. Almost every house of worship has a Zoom call, said Paul Rossenbusch, a Christian minister and writer in New York. There's a rabbi who I've known for a long time. I've never been able to go to her synagogue in L.A., but I actually watched this incredible service and I was just blown away. It was the night before Yom Kippur, and it was just so moving. Bob Roberts, an evangelical pastor at Northwood Church in East Texas, said that while he misses the community of religious services, Zoom calls can be more personal. The only thing that you can do now is meet in small groups, he said. There's more community on some Zoom calls than there is in person, because you're looking at everybody's faces, not the backs of their head. It's surprisingly easy to find online services. If you see a church when you're driving home or your cousin raves about her temple, look it up. Local media outlets publish lists, or you can sleuth one out across the country or the world. Next, think like a poet. Hamid Entazam feels especially well prepared for pandemic life. A practicing Sufi, he is a presenter on a Farsi language television show about spirituality in Islam called Partave Nur, or Ray of Light. An important part of Islam, Mr. Entazam said, is perseverance, or sabr in Arabic. Life, he said, is full of suffering, and our job is to find the path through it. But that path can be sublime. You need to acquire beauty-seeking eyes so you can find beauty in the world, including in turmoil, tragedies, and hardships of life, he said. There is still beauty to be seen. He said it is that ability that allows poets and artists to recognize and portray the beauty others don't see. In the same way, there is beauty in your home, friends, and co-workers, just waiting to be found. Next, forgive your enemies. Finding beauty in your friends and co-workers is easy. The real challenge is finding beauty in people who hate you. You love your neighbor, or you love your family, said Mr. Roberts with a wry smile. What's the bigger deal or special about that? Love your enemies. Mr. Roberts said he's done weekend retreats for colleagues. Inviting imams worried about gun-toting Christians, and Christians he knows to be leery of Muslims. At first they keep their distance, but once they do some kind of manual labor together, the barriers break down. He said it's a myth that godly actions follow a change of heart. First do the actions, start the process, and the love and forgiveness will come along later. But the hardest enemies to love, he said, are the people closest to you, the people who know how to really hurt you or have hurt loved ones. It's easier to realize you misunderstood a faceless enemy than to forgive someone you understand perfectly well. The first step, Mr. Pastor said, is to remember the people who have forgiven you, even when you were clearly in the wrong. Once you tap into that gratitude, forgiveness for others comes easily. The greatest forgiveness you offer people are to those who don't ask it, he said. Light a candle. It is not a coincidence that many, many religious traditions have some form of a festival of light in the dead of winter, Rabbi Klingfeld said. The act of lighting a candle can be an act of hope. In fact, some have argued the real miracle of Hanukkah wasn't that a temple's oil lasted for 8 days. It was that someone had enough hope to light it on the first day, he said. Rabbi Klingfeld said the meaning this year, the lighting of Hanukkah candles, will take on a much deeper meaning. Ms. Blackman agrees. So many people have died alone, with loved ones just out of reach, she said. I want people to know that they're not alone, and a candle does that, by reminding us we're spiritually connected. Rabbi Klingfeld plans to bring his community together via computer screens every night for the Festival of Lights, if just for the effect. There's something cool about 20 or 40 or 6 or 8 Zoom screens at any time in a dark room, he said. And all of a sudden, lighting the candle and you see those lights coming on, and we sing the blessings together. Rediscover your charity. Serving others is one of the best ways to exercise spirituality, Mr. Rauschenbusch said. While you may not feel comfortable spending time at a soup kitchen right now, donating money doesn't have to be a soulless tax write-off. He said if you can afford it, set aside a few dollars every day or week to donate to a new charity and learn about it. Make it a project, a moment to empathize and give. If you have children in your life, let them decide where to donate it and teach them about the environment or social ills. Donating money is one of the oldest rituals connected with religion, Mr. Rauschenbusch said. He added that the key to any ritual is reflection, followed by action, and then a sense of communion. Ms. Blackman said that if you don't have money, you still have a lot to offer. Spirituality for her is woven to a sense of community, and she finds hope in delivering home-cooked meals to older adults living alone. You can also collect supplies for the homeless, volunteer at or send supplies to organizations desperate for support. But she said the best charity is the simplest. Write a letter, she said. It's a very comforting thing to get a letter. Write letters to people, maybe in your family, that you haven't connected with for a long time. Last, find a way to grieve. Ms. Blackman said that the hardest part of the pandemic has been the inability to mourn with friends and family those who have died. It's simply difficult to gather in order to say goodbye. Too many people have died alone, she said, and left others to mourn alone. For Ms. Blackman, this isolation is tragic. It will be the lasting scar of the pandemic. She has no advice to alleviate this pain beyond just finding a way to be with the bereaved. It's not about what you say. It's just reminding people that they don't have to be alone, she said, pausing a moment. That they're not all alone. We'll turn next to an article from the Associated Press, and this article is dated December 1st. The headline, Coronavirus Robs Biblical Bethlehem of Christmas Cheer. This is by Jalal Hassan of the AP Dateline Bethlehem West Bank. The coronavirus has cast a pall over Christmas celebrations in Bethlehem, all but shutting down the biblical town revered as Jesus' birthplace at the height of the normally cheery holiday season. Missing are the thousands of international pilgrims who normally descend upon the town. Restaurants, hotels, and souvenir shops are closed. The renowned Christmas tree lighting service will be limited to a small group of authorized people, as will church services on Christmas Eve. Bethlehem is dead, said Mariana Alarja, owner of the 120-room Angel Hotel on the outskirts of Bethlehem. The hotel was the site of the West Bank's first coronavirus outbreak when a group of Greek tourists came down with the virus last March. She kept her 25 workers on staff for several months, but ultimately couldn't continue to pay them. Alarja, who herself was infected with the virus, said she has been forced to close the hotel and lay off the entire staff because there's no sign of the pandemic ending or tourists visiting anytime soon. We had 351 tourist groups booked in our hotel this year, each one 150 people, she said, but they all canceled. Elias Alarja, the head of the city's hotel association, said Bethlehem received some 3 million tourists in 2019. With Israel, the main entry point for international visitors to the region, banning tourists because of the coronavirus crisis, and the West Bank's border crossing with Jordan closed to foreigners, that number is close to zero this year, he said. 60% of the city relies on tourism, and their income disappeared when the tourists disappeared, said Al Arja, a cousin of the Angel Hotel owner. The Ambassador Hotel, which is located near the Church of the Nativity, built on the site where Christians believe Jesus was born, has reopened one floor in hopes that some local visitors may want to come celebrate in the coming weeks. Mahmoud Tarman, the hotel's receptionist, said the ambassador has brought back 8 of its 60 workers to serve local guests. But with the West Bank's economy devastated by repeated lockdowns, it remains unclear how many people will come. At this time of year, the empty hotel would be bustling with life. But as you see, there is no life, not even a Christmas tree yet, he said, as he pointed at the empty lobby. The Palestinian Authority, which administers parts of the Israeli-occupied West Bank, this week imposed a new nighttime lockdown to help contain a spike in coronavirus cases. People must remain indoors from 7 p.m. until 6 a.m., and Bethlehem is included in the lockdown. Officials say the lockdown could be extended through Christmas and into the new year if the infection levels don't come down. The health ministry has reported a total of about 65,000 coronavirus cases in the West Bank and over 620 deaths. Bethlehem's mayor, Anton Salmon, said the city had planned to receive 3,000 invited guests, including local scout troops and musical bands from around the world that normally entertain visitors during Christmas Eve festivities. He said the famed Christmas tree lighting, scheduled on Thursday, will be limited to just 15 guests, including local mayors, the district governor, and the Latin patriarch and other clergy. The 85-year-old Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, who usually joins the celebration, has been invited but has not said whether he will attend. Midnight Mass, a solemn event led by the Latin Patriarch that is usually attended by religious leaders, local VIPs, and hundreds of pilgrims from around the world, has also been scaled back, Salmon said. He said officials are still working on the guest list, but it is expected to include religious leaders and some foreign diplomats. The event will be closed to the general public, but broadcast live for people to watch. No one can hold the responsibility of inviting large numbers of people to Christmas events, he said. Nothing will be the same during the pandemic. Our next article this week on Religion in the News comes from the November 29th issue of Discover Magazine, and the title, The Complicated History of Religion and Archaeology. Religion was closely intertwined with archaeology in the early days of the science, but what happens when the relationship becomes too close? And this is by Daryl Austin of Discover Magazine. The Temple Mount is one of the most popular destinations in the ancient city of Jerusalem. In Arabic, it's known as Haram al-Sharif, the noble sanctuary. Considered the holiest site in Judaism and third holiest in Islam, it is where, according to the Bible, King Solomon built the first temple for the Jews. It's also said to be the location where Abraham offered his son Isaac as a sacrifice, and where the prophet Muhammad made his miraculous night journey to the throne of God. The Golden Dome of the Rock atop the Temple Mount commemorates that event, which is sacred in Islam. While visiting such hallowed ground today, it's easy to forget that the Temple Mount's significance maybe wouldn't be known without the archaeological excavations and discoveries that began more than 150 years ago. Biblical archaeologists have long been motivated by their faith to explore the historicity of biblical events. Today, these researchers are trained in the field, but that wasn't always the case. The first archaeological endeavors in the Holy Land were conducted not by archaeologists, but by theologians, biblical scholars, and engineers, primarily interested in locating places mentioned in the Bible, writes Eric Klein in his book, Biblical Archaeology, A Very Short Introduction. Klein, an anthropology professor at George Washington University, credits an American minister, Edward Robinson, with many early archaeological discoveries across the Holy Land. Robinson explored Palestine in 1838 with an American missionary who was fluent in Arabic and identified more than 100 sites mentioned in the Bible. Some noteworthy finds include the Siloam Tunnel and Robinson's Arch at the Temple Mount, which was named in Robinson's honor. Though Klein notes that Robinson's contributions were religiously motivated, his efforts are still recognized by academic archaeologists today. And Robinson was far from the last to be inspired by religion to explore the ancient world. A surprising number of findings have come to light by religiously motivated archaeologists and religious organizations. Interest in the ancient Mediterranean, driven by religious organizations, led to a lot of early descriptive and chronological work that was useful when we knew very little, says John Henderson, an anthropology professor at Cornell University. For instance, the Catholic Church's Pontifical Commission for Sacred Archaeology was responsible for expansive catacomb excavations in Rome, along with many other endeavors in nearby regions. And this type of work has gone beyond Europe and the Middle East. Scores of historical sites across Central and South America, including digs in San Isidro, El Mirador, Izapa, and the Paso de la Armada, have been funded or explored by religious organizations interested in the outcome of excavation. For instance, discoveries of Olmec civilizations across the Gulf of Mexico and the Pacific coastal regions of Chiapas have likewise been funded by religious groups. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints began funding such projects in the mid-20th century in hopes of finding locations mentioned in one of their religious texts, the Book of Mormon. What started out as an effort to corroborate findings in a book of scripture evolved into an academic organization, the New World Archaeological Foundation, or NWAF, which has added a number of contributions to Mesoamerican archaeology. They made meticulous site maps and carried out competent excavations, says Norman Hammond, an emeritus professor of archaeology at Boston University and senior fellow at Cambridge University. Hammond said it was the NWAF's support that helped bring to light many of the lesser-known sites beyond the spectacular temples that made Mayan civilization famous. Fred Valdez, an anthropology professor at the University of Texas, also commented on the work of the NWAF. While I can't address the reasoning behind the NWAF's strong archaeological interests, he says, there is no doubt that the archaeology undertaken and published by them has been of great significance toward understanding Maya civilization. While some archaeological digs and excavations are funded by government grants, others are still dependent on private funding. Religious organizations sometimes step in as the lone source of financial assistance when it isn't available anywhere else. Funding is very competitive and hard to get, says Susan Gillespie, an anthropology professor at the University of Florida. As a result, she says that archaeological projects are often funded by religious organizations or just wealthy donors who are religious. The cost of excavations and analysis can be enormous. Some digs take months or even years to complete, and experts can be expensive to enlist. There's also the cost of specialized tools and equipment needed, significant travel expenses, and the arduous process of preserving ancient artifacts. That doesn't take into account the work that must occur before digging even begins. Preparations include extensive site research, the accumulation of documentary evidence, and the process of finding funding sources once these preliminary steps are completed. Some religious organizations may fund archaeological projects that go beyond their scope of interest. Hammond says that leaders of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints provided him with generous financial support to cover some of his expenses while he was excavating the early Mayan site of Cuello in northern Belize during the 1970s. Hammond says that the church leaders were aware he was a religious skeptic, but they offered him financial support anyway. Our work produced no support for LDS beliefs, but no negative feedback ever happened, he said. Involvement of religious organizations isn't always positive, however, and many academic archaeologists are discouraged by the way they can hinder the work. For example, the Temple Mount may never be fully excavated or studied extensively due to its religious importance to multiple faiths and the ongoing Israeli-Palestinian conflicts there. An Islamic trust currently manages the site, and its managers, an organization known as the Jerusalem Islamic Waqf, says the site is too sacred for any further archaeological excavations. To add to that, there is also a history of religious believers ignoring or even burying scientific conclusions in an effort to promote unsupported religious beliefs. In the beginning of archaeology, most interpretations were made in support of the Bible because to do otherwise would be heresy, Gillespie says. But even modern archaeological findings can have devastating consequences when religious interpretations are applied. The city of Beirut, Lebanon, not far from the ancient city of Jerusalem, is one such example. Throughout much of Beirut's history, Arabic Muslims and Canaanite Phoenicians were thought to be one people. But when French archaeologists started digging in Lebanon, they discovered that there may have been two distinct peoples tied to the region, an idea contested by some scholars but perpetuated by certain religious groups. Some Christians didn't want to be seen as Arabs because to them, Arabs were Muslim, writes Rose Eveleth in an article for Aeon. While some archaeologists believe there is still more history to uncover, officials authorized most of the ancient city to be bulldozed. The city was rebuilt in favor of modernization, but some are skeptical about the true motivation. Archaeologist Albert Nakake, quoted in Eveleth's Aeon story, claimed the city's renovation were motivated by religion to preserve the notion that Beirut is an Arab-only nation. Beyond that, archaeological work is hindered when religiously influenced agencies decide what ancient sites should be excavated and which ones should not. Archaeologists argue that the Israeli government favors saving ancient Jewish sites, especially in Jerusalem, over ones linked to other religions, science journalist and Israel native Josie Glasiutz writes for Nature. Religious bias can also complicate interpretations of findings once discoveries are made. One problem with archaeology stimulated by organized religion is that the funders, and often the practitioners, are fully committed to particular versions of the past, Henderson says. He adds that it's always hard in archaeology to avoid the trap of inevitably finding what you expect and failing to see anything that you expect to be absent. Adding religion to the picture makes it even harder. Regardless of whether such devotion has led to disillusion, this much is certain. Religious organizations have made an impact. My guess is that if organized religions had not been interested in archaeology, Henderson says, our view of history would be substantially different. We'll turn next to an opinion piece from the Washington Post by John Gehring, who is the Catholic Program Director at Faith and Public Life Action Fund and author of The Francis Effect, A Radical Pope's Challenge to the American Catholic Church. This article is entitled, Wilton Gregory Could Be the Religious Bridge Builder Joe Biden Needs. When Washington Archbishop Wilton Gregory became the first African-American cardinal on Saturday during a ceremony in Rome, the historic moment was one of particular pride for Catholics in the nation's capital. But it's Gregory's prominent pulpit a few blocks from the White House that puts him in the national political spotlight at the same time the first Catholic president since John F. Kennedy prepares to take office. Gregory and President-elect Joe Biden are poised to become important allies during an era of deepening divisions in both the United States and the Catholic Church. Catholics from the same generation, Gregory, age 72, and Biden, age 78, are bridge builders who look for common ground, a style that can feel out of fashion these days, especially in Washington. Though Gregory has had a prickly relationship with President Trump, he could become a key sounding board for Biden. The new cardinal sent a warm welcome message to the Biden administration. I want to begin whatever conversations ensue in a positive vein, rather than in an adversarial mode, Gregory told CBS News. In contrast, Catholic and other conservative religious leaders who view abortion as the defining fault line in politics have already embarked on a tense relationship with the president-elect. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, for instance, recently announced a special working group focused on what Los Angeles Archbishop Jose Gomez called Biden's positions that undermine our preeminent priority of the elimination of abortion. Gomez went further by saying the president-elect causes confusion among the faithful because of his support for abortion rights, a curious claim given that most Catholics know what the Church teaches on this issue, and yet, according to polling, a majority of Catholics oppose criminalizing the procedure. Gregory disagrees with Biden on abortion, but his public statements recognize that protecting life can't be reduced to a single issue. This puts him on the same page with his boss, Pope Francis, who called Biden after his victory and accentuated areas where the Vatican and the White House can work together to address global poverty, refugees, and climate change. I would much prefer that the bishops of the United States had used Pope Francis's more expansive description of the life issues, Gregory told NPR last month, signaling his disagreement with the U.S. bishops' choice to define abortion as the preeminent issue in an election year guide for Catholic voters. These other life issues include economic inequality, what the Pope calls an economy of exclusion that kills, as well as protecting migrants and addressing racism, which Gregory has compared to a deadly virus. In his first public statement after being installed as Washington's first black archbishop in May of last year, Gregory criticized President Trump for diminishing our national life after a series of demeaning tweets the president directed at lawmakers of color. After federal officers used tear gas to clear protesters for Trump's Bible-toting photo op in front of St. John's Episcopal Church in D.C. this summer, Gregory called it baffling and reprehensible that the St. John Paul II National Shrine welcomed the president the next day. The president-elect is preparing to overturn Trump-era policies on the environment, refugee policy, and immigration in ways that are more aligned with Catholic social teaching. Biden has appointed his fellow Catholic John F. Kerry as special presidential envoy for climate. Both Kerry and Biden have praised the Pope's role in rallying world leaders to address climate change. During his tenure as Atlanta's Archbishop, Gregory worked with scientists at the University of Georgia to develop a detailed action plan to implement Francis's environmental encyclical, Laudato Si, in Catholic schools and churches. Gregory has also challenged policies that target refugees and calls xenophobia racism's clone, an area where the cardinal and president-elect are closely aligned. When Biden recently announced plans to roll back Trump administration policies and dramatically increase the number of refugees resettled in the United States, he did so in a speech to the Jesuit Refugee Service, a Catholic organization. And while bishops will clash with the president-elect's stated goal of broadening protections for LGBTQ people, Biden could possibly find a more sympathetic ear from Washington's new cardinal, who has earned a national reputation in church circles for welcoming LGBTQ Catholics. The nation's first black cardinal and the second Catholic president share a commitment to social justice and finding common ground. Our nation and the world would benefit if they can overcome divisions and work together for the common good. We've got just a couple more minutes this week, and so a short article from the Associated Press will wrap us up. This article from from December 3rd, Justice's order review of California virus rules for churches, Dateline Washington. The Supreme Court on Thursday ordered a lower federal court to re-examine California restrictions on indoor religious services in areas hard hit by the coronavirus in light of the justice's recent ruling in favor of churches and synagogues in New York. The High Court's unsigned order, with no noted dissent, leaves the California restrictions in place for now. But it throws out a federal district court ruling that rejected a challenge to the limits from Pasadena-based Harvest Rock Church and Harvest International Ministry, which has more than 160 churches across the state. Last week, the Supreme Court split 5-4 in holding that New York could not enforce certain limits on attendance at churches and synagogues. With a sharp increase in coronavirus cases in recent weeks, California Governor Gavin Newsom has put most of the state under heightened restrictions, which include a ban on indoor singing and chanting. We've reached the end of our time for this week on Religion in the News. We certainly hope you've enjoyed it, and thank you for being a part of our program. I'm Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina News Service, and the contents of this program are intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Don't forget that podcasts of this and other Religion in the News broadcasts are available on our website at ncreadingservice.org. Click the Listen section and then select the podcast link to find archived editions of Religion in the News broadcasts. If you see a story you'd like to see featured on a future episode, let us know about it. Feel free to give us a call at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. We thank you very much for listening. Hope you've enjoyed the program, and we'll talk to you next time. This has been Religion in the News from the North Carolina Reading Service.